Hello and welcome to the next episode of the Palisades Podcast. I'm Steve Krohn.
And I'm Maryam Czar.
And we are delighted to have with us one of our favorite people, someone who has lived in the Palisades in the same house for over 50 years. She's had an incredible career, and Maryam and I are delighted to introduce you to Ann Kerr Adams. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here. Thank you. It's wonderful to have you with us. Steve and I have been so excited to speak to you for months and months now. We've been looking forward to having this opportunity to talk to someone whose life has spanned both a truly American life and a global experience that's really valuable, especially right now as we look across the Middle East, because, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about that experience, but you spent years and years in the Middle East. You lived in Beirut. Mm-hmm. Your husband was the president of the American University of Beirut, which is an institution. So tell us a little bit about what got you to the Middle East, and then maybe we can go back and talk about your childhood.
Indeed, my life does encompass this area because I was born in Santa Monica, went to all the public schools, Samo High, and in the 50s, Samo High was so enlightened. I had no idea that anywhere in this country there were separate drinking fountains or separate hotels, because Samo High in the 50s was completely natural to mix with all different races. And we had boys' foods and girls' auto mechanics. And I ran it for student body president against an African-American guy, and he won.
Is remarkable.
Yes,
what
and you probably know him, 52. And you probably know him, Nat Travis. He's very active in Santa Monica. You might have heard of him. Mm-hmm. Anyway, a lovely, lovely man. And he definitely deserved to win. He was a much better politician than I was. But anyway, that's Samo High and Santa Monica, and then the Palisades. As Steve said, we've had our family at the house I now live in for 50 years, though obviously many of those years were spent in the Middle East. So go back to that. I went to Occidental College right across town, which was a wonderful liberal arts school, rather small. And after my sophomore year, I really wanted some wider experiences and adventures. And so I looked at all the programs to go abroad, and I found this one actually sponsored by the Presbyterian Church to send people to a few different places. One was India. Yeah. And I thought, oh gosh, that would be fascinating. I'd love to go to India. My parents said, better go to Europe. And I thought that sounded less interesting. Mm-hmm. And so we found right in the middle the American University of Beirut, which was indeed a small liberal arts college, a lot like Occidental, and inspiring place because of its belief in the values that I considered the traditional American values, tolerance, open critical thinking,
inclusion.
Open-mindedness. Yes, it built around that. And AUB was founded in 1866 by, we can't say missionaries solely, but people who were missionary inclined or education inclined.
Did you have any familiarity with the Middle East at that time? I mean, did you have a mental image of this place called Beirut back then?
Not really.
Yeah.
But I knew that there was a Cedars of Lebanon hospital.
Did they pronounce it that way, Lebanon?
No. No, but
that's
what I read phonetically.
Here in Los Angeles, the
yeah,
Cedars
yeah,
of Lebanon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now
I'd heard
Sinai.
Of that.
Right.
And right, now Cedars-Sinai. I'd heard of that. And then, I don't know, maybe images, Sunday school images
yeah.
of the mountains of Lebanon and Palestine. And
somehow I want to say that was very bold of you at that time to think about taking off, you know, from Santa Monica and then Occidental, which, as you say, is a school in Los Angeles, incidentally, where Barack Obama went to school. Am I right?
Right on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not at the same time, though.
No, a little later. Yeah. And he also wanted bigger things after 2 years.
You True. Went to Columbia.
Yeah.
So note to all the parents out there, send your kids to Occidental.
it also, not only does it say something about you and your sense of adventure and curiosity, but it says a lot about your parents that they would let
yes.
you go off.
Thank you for mentioning that. I had no idea till I had children, you know, those ages, what my parents, what it meant for them, what they went through.
Yeah. And what a leap they made at the time to let their daughter go
right.
to the Middle East, you know, as a sophomore in college. I do think that's remarkable. Frankly, think it's pretty remarkable that you ran for student body president as a woman and your only other competition was an African-American
well,
man.
Well, I love this story because it really speaks for what Samo High was, yes, and I yes. think still is.
And maybe a little bit of what, you know, they say, as California goes, so goes the nation. So maybe a little bit.
Maybe. I think, right. So, unfortunately, currently, I think we're a little out on our own, but we'll see.
We'll see.
Tell us a little bit about life as a woman in the Middle East back then.
It's a multi-layered thing because I was from California. I was, you know, a suntanned blonde image of what people thought were Californians, California Hollywood.
And I mean, did you show up like with your bikini in hand, and, you know, your hiking boots and stuff like that? Or did you, were you prepared and did you tone it down knowing that you're going to the Middle East?
Not at all, because when I got there, these women were dressed nines with, in those days, spike heels and knee-length tight skirts. And
I had heard that Beirut was a fashion capital way back in the 50s and 60s. That
it Tell us the year again, Anne, the year you landed.
I went in 54.
54.
Yeah.
I mean, I dare say that entire, well, maybe I can't say that entire region, but major nations in that region that are mired in conservatism right now were probably far more liberal at the time when you landed there. Am I wrong?
Yeah, and it wasn't a consideration, you know.
Right.
I had four roommates, one Shiite Muslim. I didn't know, it didn't matter if she was Sunni or Shiite. One Iraqi sort of Orthodox Christian. I think it's called a Syrian Catholic.
Yes.
There were many different ones. And two Palestinians, one Baha'i and one Greek Orthodox.
Wow.
Yeah.
You were like a United Nations in your in your
dorm. And that was AUB. And you know what? That was interesting because I was not the only girl from Santa Monica. There was one or two others. We were
Are you in touch with them?
Not those particular people.
I know you're in touch
people.
With some of your roommates.
Yeah, I am.
And I'll ask you a little bit about them because you've written about them.
Yeah. But I just want to finish because I got there and I don't want to leave the wrong impression. People who went to AUB were clearly from families that were educated and understood why their daughters could go to AUB. There were many fewer women than men students, but they represented that educated class. So, as you know, Miriam, from being from Iran, that is a definite
distinct class of people. And I do realize that. And I read some of your essays. And in fact, that very point was not lost on me. So, you know, I'm a 50-year-old from the Middle East. My mother was one of those people who in the 50s went to England to go to school and get a degree in engineering, of all things. And so it wasn't lost on me that you had met a certain caliber of people.
Yeah.
But then as you told us their stories of what's happening to them now, it was interesting to me because it seemed as though they had been felled by the same set of circumstances as everyone else. So I'll let you tell the stories, but you have some of your friends have experienced displacement as a result of conflict. And so it was interesting to me to think that those classifications that always kept us in the Middle East feeling as though we were safe and sort of away from harm turned out not to really play a role when things began to devolve in society.
Yes, yes and no.
Okay, tell me.
Okay, well, the reason I wanted to write about these roommates was to show their resilience and their ability to withstand the years and years of disruption in their lives. The two Palestinians had fled Palestine in 1947 and 8 when the Zionists came in, and they left in boats or to sail up to Lebanon, or buses, some of them. And then these women stayed in Lebanon and they never went home. But one was an artist. One was had a career in the insurance business. Another one is now, as we speak, in the Gulf, running schools with her husband.
Wow.
Private schools. And then, yes, alas, the Iraqi is no longer living. But she taught school in the school where Saddam Hussein's children, younger children, were studying.
Wow.
So I just wanted to talk about their resilience, but they were just not that different from us, you know.
Yeah. And they weren't that
I don't know if I answered your question.
You did, and I think that they weren't, in the same vein, I think they weren't any different from everyone else in their country, right, that was experiencing conflict or displacement and had to come up with some measure of resilience. I have no doubt that the women you met had the resources And I'm glad that you were able to stay in touch with them and then go on to tell their stories to the world. I find it valuable that some of the women that you knew went on to become teachers, yeah. so maybe pass on their enlightenment to a new generation. Yeah. But also with you now here at UCLA and the Fulbright program,
right.
you're continuing that tradition of cross-cultural exchange, are you not? Yeah.
I sure am. It's so gratifying. And then I'm able to teach these freshman seminars mm-hmm. using the Fulbright scholars as speakers. So it's called Perceptions of the U.S. Abroad, Discussions with Visiting Fulbright Scholars. Every week a different Fulbright scholar comes. So they get geography. They get to know a certain person from a certain country so they can identify with that person. And hopefully if we get to this before the end of the class, perceptions of our country through their eyes or through the eyes of their countrymen.
So the students are the speakers in that case?
Our Fulbright scholars are both grad students and professors, mm-hmm. and they speak.
Very interesting.
And the students are freshmen at UCLA who take these seminars for one-unit pass-fail courses to have the seminar experience and things they might not get in the regular curriculum. Mm. That's the idea.
Tell us how the Fulbright program started.
That's a nice story.
Yeah.
Senator William Fulbright from Arkansas was a senator who had to juggle the civil rights issues of the times with his own re-elections. But he, at the end of World War II, got this legislation passed in Congress to turn swords into plowshares, to use money left over from World War II funds for weapons and create this academic exchange. It's a wonderful, wonderful story.
Yes, and what an incredible accomplishment that has lasted generations.
It is. Yeah.
And certainly helps bring some understanding across the globe.
Yeah.
So I want to jump in here because I don't want to lose out on the rest of Anne's story while you were in Lebanon. We've already jumped up to the Fulbright program, which you're doing now, and we will get back to that. But I do want to, you know, once you got there, you were a student, and while you were there, you met your future husband, correct?
Right.
Malcolm. And you stayed in Beirut for quite some time, is that right?
Well, we would go back and forth. So we were there for 1 year as students together. He was getting a master's degree in Middle East studies, and I was my junior year. And then we became engaged, and I came home and finished college. He started his PhD, and we were married. And after his 2 years at grad school, we went back to AUB for 3 years, and we had two children at that time in the AUB hospital, which was a great place to have babies. And then we came back to UCLA, and he had a 20-year career here.
Before he ended up going back to AUB.
But during those 20 years, we took every opportunity to go back to the Middle East. So that's why three of my four children were born in Beirut.
And did you speak Arabic?
I later learned it, not in Lebanon, because everyone speaks English or French, and they don't. It's not the same kind of social scene, but it was in Egypt that I learned more Arabic, because you go out on the street there, and they are so welcoming. They love it if you speak any words of Arabic. And so you learn more and more and more, because it's so encouraging. So I got along in it, yeah.
And so you're back here, and you bought a house in the Palisades 50 years ago, right?
Right,
You once told me that.
Yeah.
And lived here for 20 years, and what compelled you and Malcolm to move back to Beirut after 20 years living in the Palisades?
Oh, okay. Well, because we had continued to go back and forth, and we were really leading a double life in a way, and in some ways I still do, because a whole circle of friends there, a whole circle of feeling of mission and wanting this university to continue. And we didn't mention that his parents taught there for 40 years after being in Turkey with the Near East Relief after the Armenian Genocide. They went to AUB. So Malcolm was born in AUB, and it was a family business.
A family tradition.
Yes, yeah. I even think my children now feel this, and they carry it into totally different areas.
Yeah, I know they all have varied careers. They're all
accomplished. Yeah, they do. But we can go on to that later, but I will answer your question first, I guess, by saying that within the 20 years at UCLA, we were in the Middle East for about a third or a fourth of them, and we're grateful to UCLA for letting that happen.
Well, I was an undergrad at UCLA during that time, and I remember I was a political science major.
You were?
So I knew your husband.
Did you take classes for Malcolm?
No, I never did because as I told you before, my emphasis was on India. So I was
right. Stanley Wolpert.
Wolpert and Dick Sisson.
Oh, right.
And so that was where my emphasis was rather than the Middle East. But I certainly knew about him. He was a legend.
Steve, that makes sense because you've always had such a curiosity, an unmistakable curiosity about the world. But I know you as, you know, the ace attorney, Steve Krohn. Now, that explains it. You did spend some time in Eastern Europe just by the goodness of your soul. So I guess you do have some...
Yeah, all of us have lived abroad. I mean, maybe that's one of the attractive things about this podcast is that we've...
Yeah.
You lived in the Middle East, I've lived in Eastern Europe.
And I've lived in the States.
And yes, which is was a foreign country for you originally, so...
May we ask when you came here, Miriam?
Sure, I was 1979, a year that might resonate. So 1978, my family began to realize that there was going to be a change in Iran. We would go from a secular form of government to a highly theocratic form of government. Mm-hmm. And so they left. We lived in Paris for about a year and then came to the States. Mm-hmm. So I've been here since I was about 10.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I had this conversation a little bit. People who've seen life outside of the States tend to really appreciate the formation of this country and the institutions and the processes that keep this country great, you know, keep it free, keep it functioning in a way that gives people a voice, a consistent voice, generation after generation.
Right.
Because you've seen this in the Middle East, you know, things change wildly from generation to generation.
Yes.
There's really very little stability that families can look back on. And here in the States, that's one of the reasons why, you know, America is such a legend around the world. Everybody wants to get to the States. So just my plug, we as American citizens really have to protect those processes and those institutions.
That's wonderful to hear. And that's a jump into this whole issue of, well, Malcolm was assassinated in his
office. You want to talk about that?
Sure. But it has so much to do with what Miriam was just talking about, because 1979, 1978, the Iranian Revolution, broke open a lot of things in the Middle East that had been fomenting for a long time and had roots in the Ottoman history, in the Mandate history written in France.
And the way the Middle East was divided up after World War
One,
arbitrary lines, putting warring groups together in a quote-unquote state, and not with the consent of the people, I don't think.
Right, exactly.
Well, and the revolution in Iran somewhat emboldened, I think, Islamists in the region, because for the first time they saw a government that was functioning under the flag of
Islam.
Of pretty militant Islam. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was emboldening. But you saw it.
But there was also this, there are many explanations and interpretations, but I watched over these decades from the 50s, 60s, 70s, how the expression of Islam changed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first got there, it was the attempt to be a secular region.
Mm-hmm.
Nasser tried to pull the Arab countries together in this Arab Union. It failed. And it was, I think that's almost a marking point for when this more desire for people to find their own roots and hence going back to a more literal conservative interpretation of Islam.
Yes, I agree with you. Yeah. I think that there was a milder form of it apparent in major cities across the Middle East until, you know, and I do think that the Islamic Revolution really demonstrated that, you know, there can be a departure from the mild form, which, you know, is a conversation for another day. And I don't think it was a great point in Middle East history.
But it's nothing's ever all of a sudden. It's
true.
Gradual. But the reason I'm pointing out that this is a transition to what happened to my husband is that we're hearing today so much about the assassination of General Soleimani. Soleimani in Iranian pronunciation, and as a leader of this organization, the Iranian Guard, Revolutionary Guard, and they were the organization that were responsible for my husband's death in 1984.
Was the Iranian Revolutionary Guard?
They were sponsors of Hezbollah.
Okay.
And Hezbollah was just
which they've
been
for a long time.
Yes.
And that was the beginning point of Iran really supporting Hezbollah and helping them grow into a militant group. Mm-hmm. Is that, am I right?
It was happening gradually.
Mm-hmm.
And when the PLO were evacuated from Lebanon, it left a vacuum. And that's when Hezbollah just slowly crept in. And when we accepted the job of president of AUB, we did mention that he was, we have already spoken, referred to the fact that he was president of AUB, right? You did.
That was the reason you went back after 20
years.
If we haven't, we have now.
Now we have. Anyway, point being that for years and years, since I had been a student at AUB, it was the PLO and the Palestinians who were the people who hijacked airplanes. Mm-hmm. But they were not a religious group. They were a secular political group. And their interest was in getting rid of Israel. And that was extreme in those days. Mm-hmm. Israel had to be pushed into the sea, blah, blah, blah. When they were involved in the Lebanese Civil War, So distinctly, it was in 1982 with the Kissinger shuttle diplomacy, and the PLO were the head, like Yasser Arafat, were being moved to Tunis, and Malcolm arrived to be president of AUB. Mm-hmm. At the he even saw them.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
On the dock. He had to sail in on a boat because the airport was closed. So he sailed in on a boat.
So as he was coming in, he could see them being evacuated.
Yeah, a lot of them going to Tunis.
And witness to history.
Their wives and children were left behind in this camp called two camps, Sabra and Shatila.
Which
and
was
you've
later
heard of that
the
massacre.
Massacre by some Christian
rightist in Lebanon. Right. And they say with the wink of the Israelis.
Ariel Sharon.
General Sharon. Phew. Anyway, at that time, we were going into Lebanon, and the PLO was leaving, and the conservative Islamic element in Lebanon, Syria, the region, was growing. Mm-hmm. And so Hezbollah made its way in, power-wise.
Did you and Malcolm know that before, and were you aware of the danger that you were walking into? I mean, obviously, if you'd known that he was going to be assassinated, I assume you wouldn't have gone. But did you look and realize you were just jumping into a steaming pot of
goo? Yeah. There was a war going on. The Lebanese Civil War had been going on for 7 years. But there seemed to be maybe a hiatus and maybe a time to come back and rebuild the university. No one knew about Hezbollah. But as I was telling Miriam as we were driving over, the acting president of AUB, after Malcolm had been appointed and was still in the U.S., the acting president was kidnapped. And no one had heard of Hezbollah. Mm. No one knew what they were doing. He was the first victim, mostly, that I know of. So it wasn't until a year later he was released and we were actually going back with our family. And David Dodge, the acting president, and Malcolm met as we were going and he was arriving. And David said to Malcolm, beware of the Iranians and this new organization, Hezbollah. I don't think it even had a name yet. So the point is, the PLO left.
And in that vacuum,
Hezbollah came in.
Hezbollah.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that affected the politics. Hezbollah was going to protect Lebanon from Israel, quote unquote, the enemy, the common enemy.
Well, and as you say, Soleimani, so at the time, Soleimani apparently got his rise in the Iran-Iraq war, which was going on right beforehand, and sort of proved his tactical sort of strategy prowess through that war. Mm-hmm. And later, so fast forward 30, 40 years later, is accredited with building up that proxy sort of system that apparently protected Iran, but chief among which was Hezbollah.
Right.
And in Farsi, Hezb, I assume in Arabic also, Hezb means party.
Party
right,
of God.
And Allah means God, so...
Yeah. Yeah,
it definitely got its fangs from the Iranian government that was feeling emboldened at the time.
Did you feel that, I don't know if you knew, but that Malcolm's assassination was like a first step by Hezbollah to show that they're in charge?
We had no idea. But we knew we were getting into a muddle with the Lebanese Civil War. And as I said to Miriam again in our earlier discussion, there were three things going on at the same time. It's important to think about that in the larger context. It was the end of the Cold War and Russia and U.S. proxy wars in Lebanon. now with Syria, right? I mean, history going on and on.
Repeating itself.
So that was, there was that war. Then there was the Lebanese, there was the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is always there. And there was the Lebanese civil war, Christian-Muslim, but 17 different militia groups. And not, it's too simple to say Christian-Muslim, because all these different militia groups represented different threads. So there was those three things going on. And Malcolm went into a danger zone. And we knew it, but we thought there was this little maybe break because the Kissinger diplomacy was carrying the PLO away, and this was going to be a chance for rebuilding. Right. And we did not know about Hezbollah. And they barely knew themselves, I think, at that time.
Right.
That's a long story.
Well, no, but it's a fascinating story. I mean,
we want to bring you back to the States, but just quickly to your life in the States, because it's equally impressive and important. But I want to ask you, as you look back with all of your insight, was there anything that the global community could have done to stem the growth or the rise or the strengthening of an organization like Hezbollah?
Yes, only if people had in the administration making the decisions had listened to all the experts, as we saw in the impeachment trial. Mm-hmm. There were people in the State Department who knew a lot and could have helped them. Mm-hmm. But we see America over and over. On C-SPAN yesterday, I was watching something on a rebuilding of Afghanistan. We didn't know a thing. We went in there and we had no idea what we were doing. So it's ignorance, really. And that's one of the things that comes out in my class, if the Fulbright scholars are honest enough. You know, Americans are thought of as the literal meaning of the word, ignorant. I mean, lacking in knowledge.
So your general thought on these areas is that if we paid attention to our professional people who are on the ground in the State Department and other agencies that are not politically affiliated, that are just there doing their jobs, we'd be a lot better off than if we're looking at the politicians who are trying to figure out how it will help them get elected or raise money from donors or what have you.
Precisely.
And I wonder if we're overlooking something now and, you know, unknowingly giving rise to something we'll recognize in 20 years, which is why I think what you do is so important because, you know, as you encourage this exchange, this cross-cultural exchange of people with different perspectives and different knowledge bases, and I guess I've thought this for at least a generation, my assumption is that you're empowering and really educating and informing the generation that's going to emerge as leaders in the future and that they'll guard against some of these errors or this mismanagement that we see. Yeah. Is that too hopeful?
Yeah, she's basically responsible
for the entire
future
of
the world by her class at UCLA. So thank you. We're honored to be with you.
I wish.
We wish, too.
Yeah. No.
But with the rise of the internet and exchange of information.
Well, there you are. That's a whole new element, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the whole scene, for good and for bad. But, I mean, how can we elect leaders who are well-informed, who have been Fulbright scholars or been abroad? Well, we did. We had Clinton, who'd been a Rhodes Scholar.
Correct.
And Obama knew the world.
Right. And you have a Rhodes Scholar right now on the stage in the Democratic field still. Pete Buttigieg was a Rhodes Scholar.
Right. I guess that I've heard that counts against him in certain elements of the population,
but
that's
sure
another
it does.
Story.
Yes. Wait, I don't think in the Palisades, but in some parts of this country, it may count against him.
Yeah. So dare we think that these universities like UCLA that have such broad reach and, you know, programs like Fulbright, which are accepted all around the world, and the ease with which people can now communicate through the internet, I mean, dare we expect better days ahead when people have more tolerance for each other or a better understanding of the underpinnings that have...
I'll let Ann answer.
No,
that's an optimistic view because, you know, the internet is great in so many ways and it's so terrible in other ways, you know, that extremist groups can communicate through the internet and gun rights groups who can sell guns over the internet. I mean, there's the good and the bad.
That's true, too. Sorry, I didn't think about that. I was just thinking about protesters around the world being able to get their word out. I mean, there are films right now that are up for Academy Awards that were made solely on, you know, refugees who sort of chronicled their journey on a telephone and were able to transfer it to, you know, someone in the States who was interested in making a film. I just wonder if communication along with awareness can possibly help us change the tide in the Middle East because, you know, we can bring it back to the States, but there have been so many spots in the world that have been mired in conflict for so long, there's got to be a change.
It sounds like you're optimistic about the internet. What do you think?
I think conflict is a human condition.
I have really mixed feelings when you read about white supremacist groups that are communicating through these various sites, and the sites can't be shut down, and they're exchanging their racist, xenophobic, anti-Semitic, anti-everything messages.
Absolutely.
That's the flip side of your optimistic
but
viewpoint.
Good leadership. And look, people, young people are demonstrating all over the world.
Correct.
And they all have authoritarian leaders. And how did this happen? You know, it's just repeated so many countries in the world.
Yeah.
But the next generation, yes.
Always the next generation.
Yeah, it's their burden, not ours. We're not going to be around.
But we don't
that.
Want to leave the world in such bad shape.
Oh, I know. That know, is
for
a sad thought.
Kids and grandkids. And
to think that we're leaving it. A polluted, increasingly hot planet with all kinds of issues that we didn't have before that could be catastrophic. And I have grandchildren, and I look at them, and I say, what are they going to be getting into? Yeah. But we won't resolve that today. I want to, as is my nature, I want to go back just a little bit. So after Malcolm was assassinated, here you are, you're a mother of four children, you're in Beirut. How do you get your life together? What do you do? I mean, do you immediately say, we're going back to the States, go back to the safety of the Palisades? As a mother, how do you get through that?
I wonder now myself, but I've had a full life since then, and and I had this marvelous second marriage, and but going back to those days, my plan was if anything happened to Malcolm, I would go back to Cairo, where I had taught, where my kids loved the school, where we had a circle of friends who would understand, not think we'd done a crazy thing going to Beirut in the middle of a civil war. So I went to Cairo to the American University of Beirut, where they offered me my job back that I'd had on a leave there a couple of years
earlier. American University of Cairo.
American University of Cairo, yes, which is similar to AUB in its values, but it was founded much later. It was founded in 1919 and AUB in 1866. Mm. But still now, AUC has a 100-year history.
Amazing. Time marches.
Yeah. But at any rate, Cairo was such an exciting place. And that was a sort of second love affair with the Middle East that I had. Mm. And so to go back there was the right situation. I felt sorry for my parents who were here, and I know would have wanted me to come home.
And how worried they probably were.
The deed was done, and they never said, I told you so.
Mm, of course.
They had before, you know, asked us why we were going. Well, they had come from Nova Scotia to California, so they had had their own journey. But anyway, Cairo was a wonderful place, and we had many friends there who had also been in...
Was Nasser in charge at the time?
No, this was much later. Nasser was in Egypt when I was a student in the 50s. And 52 was the revolution, and General Naguib took over, and then Nasser took over from him. And then it was Sadat, Mubarak, and now Sisi.
So it was during the time of Sadat when you got there?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, really?
The second time.
Yeah. With how many children?
My youngest son, who was in high school, and my oldest son was working in Cairo for Catholic Relief Services.
Oh, okay. So your two sons were older.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the youngest was 15, and my oldest was my daughter, and she was 24. So when their father was killed. Wow. And Steve was 18, and he had just started University of Arizona. And Malcolm actually got to see him play once, Tucson.
Oh, how wonderful. Yeah. And this, just for our audience to be clear, is the famous Steve Kerr, who now coaches the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah.
A poster of which is probably in the home of almost everyone listening to this podcast today.
And I, as an aside, I followed his career because he went to Pali High.
Right.
And so...
And didn't do very well in getting into college.
Yeah, I knew that.
With a scholarship.
Yeah. And yeah. Did I hear that, at least for a while, that he was, at some schools, he was taunted or he had negative experiences, people maybe just trying to distract him or whatever.
Yeah,
Taunting about his father's death.
Yes. When I said had trouble getting into college. I didn't mean because of his grades.
No.
Steve, in case you're listening.
No, he was not
he was not a sought-after basketball hero until he was seen by, and it was the summer before he was going to have to start colleges, and it was August, and he was seen by the wife of the coach of the Wildcats in Tucson.
Lute Olson.
And his wife was with him, and they were watching summer leagues. And she said, oh, who's that white guy down there? He looks like he can shoot three throws or something. So,
but he couldn't jump because he was white.
Right.
And that was adorable. He could shoot three throws.
Yeah.
I love that. That's somewhere between a three-pointer and a free throw.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. But anyway...
he was recruited.
He was recruited, and that was sort of the magic moment, because from then on...
His career skyrocketed.
Oh, it's been amazing.
He's one of those guys that, you know, from high school, you'd say, oh, he's a good high school player, and then college, he was a good college player, and nobody expected that he'd be drafted and have such a stellar career as a player and then as a coach.
Yeah.
So what has he told you about Steph Curry? Any inside information about Steph Curry?
Now, let's see what is this podcast about? He's practicing now. In fact, my daughter was visiting from England, and we went to practice the other day at UCLA in the Wooden Center, and they were practicing.
Yeah, UCLA.
It's really not easy to get in there. You have to have a special invitation.
Wow.
So, I mean.
Good for you. Moms still have a little pull with their sons.
Sometimes. It depends on where they're playing. But anyway, so we watched, and Steph was actually practicing shooting. Hmm. And he's just.
Is he making them?
I think so. Yeah. I was watching everybody. But it'll be a while. Not for the finals. I don't think for the finals.
Well,
and
so
that's
since
quite
we have...
a life. I just want to say, I don't know if you can tell because it's your life and you've lived it so authentically, but for people who listen to you, I mean, truly, if there's ever been a novel hidden within a life, it's really yours. I mean, we're talking about a young girl, you know, who was born in Santa Monica, ended up, you know, really changing things. I mean, being an agent for good in the Middle East of all places, you know, at a time in history that'll go down in the books as being, you know, complicated and fast-paced. And then back over here to the States in this idyllic neighborhood of Pacific Palisades where you raise children who now lead one of the greatest basketball teams of all time. That is quite
my daughter.
However, she has three other children, all equally accomplished in their own careers. And we've talked about it. I know they live all over the place. They don't live here in the Palisades, but I know you're equally as proud of all of your kids.
Sure, of course.
It's not just whether they have basketball rings, right?
I always like to mention that.
You want to tell us briefly about your other three kids?
Sure. So my oldest is my daughter, Susie, and she was born in Beirut, went through the public schools here and also international schools when we lived abroad. But she met a Dutchman in graduate school. He was over here studying China.
Oh, wow.
And she was doing the Middle East. They were at graduate school. And she married him. And his first job offer was Cambridge, England. And they didn't expect to stay.
They've never left.
They never left. Yeah. And
so anyway, they're in the middle of Brexit.
So she decided, it was actually, this is another part of the story. She decided after... We had a trial against the Iranian government for state-sponsored terrorism 17 years after Malcolm's death. She was living in England, and she decided that made her want to become involved in the political process where she was living. So she has a dual citizenship now, and she joined the Liberal Democrat Party and ran for district councillor, and which she was, and then she ran for county councillor. And in
which
that capacity, the Liberal Dems were very much against Brexit, but circumstances are so strange.
Mm.
As you talked about, being accustomed to frequent changes in Iran, never have thought this would happen in Britain.
Absolutely.
Nor the U.S.
Absolutely.
So what's happening anyway?
Well, that's another story, but I think Mr. Putin has a lot to do with all of that.
Yeah.
You know,
Driving
a wedge between Britain and the EU and between the United States and the EU. But anyway.
Yeah. But I love that your daughter had an instinct for politics. Even though she didn't know it, she kind of felt bubbling.
Or service to the community.
Yes.
And
yes.
Her job is more, is very local. Her meetings are always with the parish councils and, the county council too, but she works.
It's local.
I think it's gratifying to work at the local
How
level.
Lovely. How wonderful.
And the next one is John. He's an agricultural economist professor at Michigan State, is his wife. And he does a lot of international work. Mm. And then the next one is Steve, who's the coach of the Warriors. And the next one is Andrew, who's in the construction business and raising very wonderful little children. And his wife is physician's assistant. And interestingly enough, so she's Jewish, and my little grandchildren are, my 12-year-old granddaughter is studying for her bat mitzvah.
Yes.
And she asked me, Gran, are you Jewish or Christian? I said, she's asked me, are you Jewish? And I said, well, a little bit. And then later she said to me, I'm half Jewish and half Christian. So anyway.
That's sweet.
You know, we get through one means or another.
You're truly a global family. I love it.
I do too. But it's hard when they're far away.
How many grandchildren do you have?
I have 8, and I'm hoping to have great-grandchildren before too long, because my grandsons, 2 of them are married now.
Mm.
Wow.
That would be really fun.
You're quite a remarkable grandma. I'm sure as they get older and they understand more about who you were and what your life was like and Malcolm and, you know, just the trajectory of your life, I'm sure they're already proud to have you as a grandma. But that's quite a towering grandmother, and it really is a pleasure to have been able to speak to you for the past hour.
Thank you.
I think if it were up to Steve and I, we'd have you back every month.
The thought circled in my mind that we might have to think about a second hour.
Thank
at some point in the near future, because we got to you going to Cairo. We didn't quite link it up with the rest. And you have such an amazing life, and you're such a charming, lovely lady. It's just, it's so much fun to be with you and to learn from you. So
thank you.
And
thank you
have a scholarship. I want to touch on this really quickly. Does your family have a scholarship for...
We do. Well, that's a whole another story.
Mm,
but
we're going to have to. We'll have to do another.
Yes.
Okay.
And I also want to ask about your second husband, because I know
that's a romantic novel.
Yeah. So I think we'll have to talk about it.
Thank you for
a round two.
A lot.
Thank you so much.
You make me feel very happy and proud. So.
Well, you make
it's
us
truly
proud
an
to be
honor
with you.
To be with you and to have this conversation with you, really, Anne. I don't think we say that to everyone, and it really is. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
All right, and we're going to wrap up this edition of the Pally Podcast. Steve Krohn, what's up? What's up as we look ahead?
Well, we'll sign off for now. We have a whole bunch of guests that are waiting, and we'll let everybody see what we have, and it'll be published in the Palisadian Post.
That's great. You're doing
as will
the
this.
Post.
Wonderful. And coming to you from Village Studios, a historic building right here in West LA. We'll see you guys in a month.